This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
What really is the truth about the truth? Find out. Hello. Religious instruction at my Christian Brothers Day School was somewhat light on controversy. We were simply required to regurgitate the truths of Catholicism as laid down in our well-thumbed catechisms. And so it came to pass that one morning we were all required to reproduce the details of Christ's resurrection. "Well now," said the brother taking the class, "how might we best describe the Apostle Thomas's attitude towards the risen Christ?" "Yes, Humphreys?" He was sceptical, sir." "Sceptical?" roared our teacher. "Sceptical? He was not sceptical, Humphreys. He was doubting Thomas. Did you ever hear of sceptical Thomas? Don't use that word again." And that really was the origin of the Sixth Form Sceptical Society, me and Humphreys and a spotty boy called Dobson, determinedly sifting through the scriptures to find new targets for our scepticism. Well, I remember our pretentious little club when postmodernism burst upon the intellectual scene in the 1970s. All of a sudden, we were being urged to be sceptical, not about mere theological assertions, but about the accepted truths of scientific development and rationality and human progress. And some saw that invitation to doubt established truths as the origin of what we now call fake news, post-truth news, the news that has less to do with hard facts than perhaps with appeals to emotion and personal experience. It's what I believe. And that's our topic for today, not merely the nature of fake news, but also its intellectual and cultural origins, the implications of its presence for our political and social life, for evidence-based reasoning in general, for democracy, for human progress. Well, it's time to introduce my first guest. He's Steve Fuller, and he's Professor of Social Epistemology at the University of Warwick, which is a job title that I presume marks him out as someone whose principal area of interest is not only the nature of knowledge, but also the claims that are made about the relative truth of different forms of knowledge. And Steve Fuller's new book is called Post-Truth, Knowledge as a Power Game. Perhaps we could start, Steve, by just going back to the Oxford English Dictionary in 2016, which had post-truth as its word of the year. But I understand from your book that you're pretty dissatisfied with the way it defined it, how it went about telling you what it meant.
Yes, I think if you look at the Oxford English Dictionary's definition, it's a post-truth definition of post-truth, essentially. In other words, it's about positioning certain kinds of views in certain ways, where certain views are considered to be true because they appeal to reason and evidence and so forth, whereas others are considered to be false or suspect because they appeal to emotion or other irrational factors. Now, this is a very sort of self-serving definition, and here one needs to look at the timing of this, of course, because post-truth was made the Oxford English Dictionary word of the year on the back of Brexit and Trump, where the people who thought they were on the side of truth actually lost the argument very substantially. And so in a sense, the word post-truth is kind of revenge on this, you might say.
So you want to say that really the arguments about relative truths, on the one hand here, this definition is suggesting there is a certain sort of truth which owes something to emotion, and there's another sort of truth which owes something to facts, and one is superior to the other.
That's right. And I think that's really a wrong way of looking at things, frankly, because, of course, all opinions involve both appeals to reason and appeals to emotion. But the interesting thing is what the power relations are between them. And so when I talk about the idea of post-truth, what I'm really talking about is the idea of not necessarily what is true or false, but controlling the conditions under which one decides what is true or false.
And it's interesting you turn to, I can remember vaguely coming across him in my sociology courses, but I think as you suggest, he's hardly credited very much, the 19th century Italian political economist Vilfredo Pareto. Now, here you use him to introduce a contrast between two types of elite, the lions and the foxes, and their relationship to this question of truth. Expand on that for me.
Okay, very briefly. Pareto is someone who's in a tradition that goes from Plato through Machiavelli, and he's writing in the late 19th, early 20th century. And the basic fundamental principle is that truth is always something that needs to be established primarily by means of power or the enforcement of authority, which was actually what Plato's view was. However, as we get to more democratic cultures or cultures where there's less absolute control over authority, then you start to get this kind of power dynamic going on, which turns into a kind of cyclical form of conflict, which is what the lions and the foxes refer to. to. And they basically refer to two phases in this kind of conflict, a struggle over who defines truth. The lions are basically the establishment people. They are the people who normally control the rules of the game. They are the people who have tradition on their side. They are the establishment. They are the interlocking elites. They are the sort of people that, let's say, the Trump supporters and the Brexiteers are very much against. On the other hand, the foxes are the ones who say those people, despite how much power they've had for how long and how much stability they've brought in, are in fact inherently corrupt. They are in fact hiding other sorts of possible truths and other ways of actually developing society that would actually be of greater benefit to more people.
So when we come along, I'm just thinking of something like the run-up to the EU referendum in 2016. You've got Michael Gove famously quipping, people in this country have had enough of experts. I mean, you see this really as a fox against the lions. I mean, here he is saying, look, here are the established authorities, stop listening to them.
Exactly. I think Michael Gove was really onto something there. And in the sense that when we look at expertise, and here, you know, what Michael Gove was referring to, remember, wasn't just, as it were, the political elites, but also the various social scientific authorities, academics and so forth, who in fact were backing them during the Brexit campaign. And I think what Gove is alluding to here, which I think is sociologically correct, is that there is a sense in which expertise maintains its kind of power by being uniform, by being controlled, by also being in lockstep with other kinds of elites in the society that actually give it authority.
Let me just switch angles, because I've got a couple of BBC News clips here. This is the American President Donald Trump. One's from a press conference on the 13th of July 2018, in which he was being questioned by the BBC political editor Laura Koonsberg. But we begin with this extract from a press conference held on the 11th of January 2017, in which the President refuses to take a question about Russian interference in the U.S. election.
No, not you. Not you. Your organization is terrible. Your organization is terrible.
Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question. You are fake news.
Sir.
Mr. President, you seem rather to have changed your tune from what you said earlier this week when you said that on the current Brexit plan, that would probably kill the possibility of a trade deal with the UK. Our countries are meant to have a special relationship, yet you publicly criticised the Prime Minister's policy and her personally for not listening to you this week. Is that really the behaviour of a friend?
Because I didn't criticise the Prime Minister. I have a lot of respect for the Prime Minister. And unfortunately, there was a story that was done which was, you know, generally fine, but it didn't put in what I said about the Prime Minister. And I said tremendous things. And fortunately, we tend to record stories now, so we have it for your enjoyment if you'd like it. But we record when we deal with reporters. It's called fake news. And we solve a lot of problems with good old recording.
Now, I know that you would tend to regard or think of Trump almost as the ultimate fox.
Exactly.
Why?
Well, because I think this is someone who does the very foxy thing, which is to say, look, there are actually alternative sources to the ones that you've traditionally trusted. And in fact, there are reasons to think that the traditional sources of authority are not to be trusted, basically on their own record, and primarily because of the things they leave out. And as in the clip that you just mentioned, Trump refers to what's being left out, that you actually need some alternative source to actually bring out what has been left out by the traditional media.
But if we talk about these, an alternative to the traditional source, I mean, I can follow you along the lines of here are these sort of ancient lions, these authorities who lay down the law, then other people come along and try to disrupt them and so on. But if they disrupt them with facts which are absolutely clearly not facts, which are untruths, then, I mean, are we going to countenance that? Is that something to celebrate? Are we saying this is the only way the foxes can win?
Well, first of all, I don't think we should assume, and here I'm on the side of the foxes, that in fact the traditional media were quite up to the standards of truth that they claim themselves to be. So I think there was always room for a certain amount of skepticism and even doubt with regard to them. But in any case, I do think there's a kind of fundamental reality that we have to sort of deal with in the future with regard to this, and that is that the general top-down broadcast model of how information and news is provided is breaking down. And so, like it or not, we're living in this more distributed, kind of horizontalized, lateralized medium where more and more people will be able to actually start, as it were, producing information and news.
I can understand people who might feel they want another source of news, say, rather than the authority like old established BBC or something like that. But you're not arguing for another sort of news which produces unreliable facts, unreliable reports.
No, and if, look, my view about this is that actually there is nothing wrong with criticism and conflict going across both sides of the different sorts, you know, of the alternative forms of media that are available. So I have nothing against that. I do think one problem that is going to arise, because there is going to be this cacophony of conflicting voices, that people, and I think they already are getting savvier and savvier with regard to discriminating between various kinds of news sources. And it's going to be that kind of, it's going to be a kind of trial by, you know, trial and error kind of learning experience. But I think people are already beginning to have that.
Okay, well, Steve, well, thank you very much for the moment. Now, I've always found there's nothing quite so intellectually debilitating, or indeed actually it's quite so comical, as the sight and sound of a pack of academics in possession of a new theoretical perspective. Overnight, committed orthodox Marxists became revisionist Althusserians, strict dynamic Freudians transmuted into linguistic Lacanians. But in all my years teaching at university, years during which I also ebbed and flowed with intellectual currents, no new theoretical perspective had quite such an impact as postmodernism. Part of its appeal was the manner in which it claimed to undermine all those big meta-narratives that had dominated thinking for so many years. Marxism, Christianity, progress, science. And along with that subversion of big stories, postmodernism ushered in a new delight with fragmentation, the disruption of ordered surfaces, such as the distinction between high and low culture, the subversion of cultural conventions in such television comedies as The Office and films like Monty Python and The Holy Grail. Well, to what extent did that happy subversion of reality provide the basis, set the scene for what people have described as the present era of post-truth? Well, let me bring in my second guest today. She's writer, Helen Pluckrose, and she's the editor of Aereo, which is a digital magazine which focuses primarily, at least according to my reading of it, upon the Enlightenment, liberalism, humanism and freedom of expression. Now, as I'm saying, Helen, you're editing a magazine which I think I might be right in saying champions the values of the Enlightenment. I mean, what is it that you want to value about that particular tradition?
Well, the Enlightenment, like postmodernism, is just such a huge term. But when we're talking in terms of knowledge, then what we're thinking with the Enlightenment is that there is a belief that objective truth exists and that humans can access it using evidence and reason. We would say there is a great deal of evidence that this has worked, that it has caused much advance in science, much moral progress, and that it can continue to do so if not derailed by religious narratives, by populism or by postmodernism.
Tell me a little bit more about the way, because, I mean, to an extent, as I've been describing it, postmodernism was just a little senior common room cult, you know, in which people started to enjoy themselves rather talking about how clever they were at subverting established routines, whatever. But you want to say, really, it had a much bigger effect than that. It spread out from the senior common rooms.
Yes, I think we were looking in the late 60s, whether we call it the postmodern turn or the new cultural logic, we're looking at a profound epistemic shift, at least in academia. And this, although it sort of came from different directions all at once, and we suddenly had a lot of narratives about the role of knowledge, that knowledge is constructed by power. For Foucault, this was so central that he joined the words power knowledge. And for Lyotard, the language of power, the language of science was so inextricably linked with government and ethics that it couldn't be untangled. And this role of discourse, the way we talk about things in constructing knowledge in the service of power, is really what defines that postmodern shift. It's so enormous, you could be talking anything from architecture to steampunk, but in this sense,
You're mentioning that other way in which people try to validate what it is that they're saying. I mean, by reference to themselves, you know, only I, because of my identity, can have had this particular experience, so only I am qualified to speak on this subject.
Well, yeah, to some extent, but really, postmodernism was quite a lot about dissolving the subject.
Oh, yes.
And so, yes, there is this ideal that my knowledge is no better than your knowledge, that our ways of determining knowledge are equal. But then we had the second wave, because this pure sort of deconstructive approach, it kind of raged with prolific writings from the late 60s to the mid 80s, and it sort of lost steam eventually. And we had the second wave of very specifically identity-based theorists. We had the intersectionals, the critical race theorists, the queer theorists, the post-colonials. And they took a very different approach to it. They wanted to keep those aspects of postmodernism, that idea that knowledge is a construct of power conveyed in language. But they pointed out, I mean, Mary Poovey and Kimberly Crenshaw particularly pointed out that we can't actually do a lot unless we say that women, for example, are a thing that actually exist and experience similar things in a certain time or place. So this became much more sort of user-friendly. It became simplified. We can say that structures of power exist. This is sort of a bit of a return to truth claims. But we can work from there, and this is something that activists could use. They could sort of take it on. It's coming at the end of the last sort of bit of the civil rights movements, gay pride, liberal feminism, and so it appealed to the wider public.
Now, so therefore, really, you want to say that this postmodernism, this sort of doubting of reality, this undermining of old established truths, that really that we can now talk about sort of fake news as really having descended from that?
I wouldn't say explicitly descended, no. I think, Steve has said, this making up of narratives and believing them is a human thing. It's what we do instinctively. We're a narrative species. The weird societies, Western educated, industrialised, rich, democratic, are a relatively new and unusual thing. We had to work to maintain that. So this isn't from postmodernism precisely, but it did disrupt the gatekeepers of the requirement to give evidence for claims, to have a reasoned argument for them.
But how much would you want to accept of what Steve was talking about, the idea, for example, that here are established centres of power who lay down what the truth is, but society is really rather better for having some foxes around who come along and disrupt those established. I mean, there is that you would not want to dismiss the idea of challenging centres of authority and centres of power?
Absolutely not. What I would say is that there are different ways of challenging, because what quite often postmodernists and critics of the Enlightenment do is they present science and institutions and expertise as this body of knowledge. It's there, we have the facts, we tell them to you. But when we're looking at science, what we are really looking at is a process, and it's a sceptical process. The purpose of science, when done well — I'm not claiming that all scientists and all institutions have done it well — but the purpose of science as a process is to be sceptical, is to challenge established truths, is to try and falsify itself. Mm-hmm. So we have postmodernism, which quite often sort of overstates itself as something new, which is challenging these establishments, when in fact there is a form of scepticism, there is a form of... you know, for science, knowledge is always provisional. Hypotheses are never proven. They're only disproven. This is a sort of functional sceptical system.
Helen Buckrose, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, there you go. Thus spake Zarathustra. A useful musical reminder, perhaps, that it was Nietzsche who composed one of the most stirring, if dismissive, descriptions of so-called truth. What then is truth? And Nietzsche answers, truth is a mobile army of metaphors, metonyms, and anthropomorphisms. In short, a sum of human relations which have been enhanced, transposed, and embellished poetically and rhetorically, and which, after long use, seem firm, canonical, and obligatory to a people. Truths are illusions about which one has forgotten that is what they are. Metaphors which are worn out and without sensuous power, coins which have lost their pictures and now matter only as metal, no longer as coins. But I should let George Orwell provide us perhaps with the most potent literary antidote to Nietzschean relativism. These cautionary words all come from 1984. How do we know that two and two make four, wrote Orwell, or that the force of gravity works, or that the past is unchangeable? If both the past and the external world exist only in the mind, and if the mind itself is controllable, what then? And this, being in a minority, even in a minority of one, did not make you mad. There was truth and there was untruth, and if you clung to the truth, even against the whole world, you were not mad. Well, if you'd like to add your own words to feature in this debate, you'll find us at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk, where you can also consult our burgeoning archive and fix up a download.
How could you believe me when I said I love you, when you know I've been a liar all my life?
You've had that reputation since you was a youth.
You must have been insane to think I'd tell you the truth.
I've been looking through the tabloid headlines for today, that is Wednesday the 19th of September, and what have I found? Exclusive: Putin tried to kill me with rat poison. Toxic air to blame for 60,000 cases of dementia. Stormy Daniels claims it may have been the least impressive sex I've ever had. Well, I suspect that most of us are not too alarmed by this manner of adding some dramatic luster to routine news stories. It's what the tabloids do. Get over it. But might this sort of complacency be a little bit more dangerous when such dramatisation is applied to political stories and political information? And when we live in an era in which such representations receive hugely increased audiences via all those various digital platforms? In the past, a man who believed the BBC was run by Martians could only broadcast such a view to his wife and a couple of mates in the saloon bar. But now, digital platforms provide the opportunity for such views to be disseminated to millions, all of which suggests that we need some research on such sharing behaviour. Well, enter my final guest today. He's Andrew Chadwick, and he's Professor of Communications at Loughborough University, and he's the lead author of a research article entitled "Do Tabloids Poison the Well of Social Media? Exploring Dysfunctional News Sharing." What got you going on this research? What started you off?
Sure. Well, during 2016, when the fake news crisis hit in the US, a few of us from the UK looked over there and said, well, we've got a tabloid press that has been dealing with this sort of stuff. It's their stock in trade. So what would happen if we kind of took the idea of fake news and applied it to different national contexts, specifically the British context? So what we wanted to look at really were the ingredients that make up the decision to share on social media. And we wanted to examine whether there are any links between people's specific motivations to try and influence others, you know, to amuse them, to persuade them to engage in debate and so on. The news sources they share, a range of control variables, such as things like political interest and so on, and specific behaviours that we call democratically dysfunctional news sharing. And so if I can just talk about those, because it's probably the most controversial part of the research. So we asked a range of questions. We asked people whether or not, and this is people on Twitter who we surveyed, a large number of them, we asked people whether they'd shared news in the past month that seemed accurate at the time, but they later found was made up. Whether it was exaggerated and they weren't aware of that, whether it was exaggerated and they were aware of this and shared it anyway, or whether they shared news that they thought was made up when they shared it.
I mean, what in a way you're trying to do, you are trying, I mean, my question about the fact that, you know, there used to be a man who could just go down and speak to a couple of mates in the pub, that's hardly significant, you know, they probably dismiss it or wave it away. But you were talking here about this having real political effects, the degree of sharing of misinformation or disinformation which is going on.
That's right. We distinguish between misinformation, which is inadvertently sharing things that might have been made up, and disinformation, where the people involved are specifically motivated, they know that it's false information. But what's interesting to us in all of this is really the different types of media sources, because people, when they're online on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, they have to have some raw materials to try and fulfill their goals. So when a person has a goal of misinforming or disinforming others, or rather disinforming others, because that's an overt motive, we were interested in the ingredients that make up that calculus, that decision. And what we found in our research, Laurie, which was rather surprising to us, that people who share tabloid sources, the more that you share those tabloid sources, the more there are correlations or links between news media types, motivations, and the idea of disinforming.
And of course, when you're talking about tabloid sources, you're not. I mean, you're talking about the newspapers, but you're talking about the success or the huge success of things like the tabloid actually online, where those online sites are now being accessed by millions of people.
Well, that's it, exactly. If you look at the digital reach of the tabloid press in the UK now, it is huge. They've adapted very, very rapidly. If you look at figures from Ofcom from last year, the digital reach of tabloid papers, they now reach something like two-thirds of the monthly digital audience. So if you look at the likes of The Sun, The Mail, The Mirror, they're doing extraordinarily well. At the heart of our approach here is a framework that we call media as resources. So in other words, we've got this idea, this ontology, if you will, that you are what you read, you share what you read, and you are what you share. So in other words, there's got to be some kind of raw material for people to share that satisfies their motivation to disrupt the grounds of truth on which politics
Why do you pick on the tabloids? I mean, I suppose people might sort of go along with the idea that if you look at the tabloids, you're more likely to find stories that are made up or dramatised or whatever. But, isn't The Guardian or The Times or The Telegraph, isn't there misinformation that could be obtained there?
I think that there's always problematic information across all types of journalism. But in our statistical model, what we did was we analysed the tweets that people had actually shared online and we correlated those with their behaviours. And the news sources that people shared, we categorised into six types. So we looked at quality news, we looked at broadcasters, and we looked at international news, and we looked at so-called online native news, the likes of The Canary and also Huffington Post, the more centrist quality online outlets. But the only link that we found between a news type and the motivation to misinform and disinform others is with tabloids.
So you really, your question, do tabloids poison the well of the social media? You are concerned about this growing influence and what you believe is the increase in the amount of misinformation which is being passed on from person to person.
Sure, we've got a very British perspective on this, if I may, which is that we know that the tabloids have been hugely influential in politics over the last 4 or 5 decades. We now argue that they are extending that influence, albeit indirectly, through the influence of sharing, onto social media.
OK, and there we must start. That's Andrew Chadwick and Steve Fuller and Helen Parker. Last word. I mean, Steve, I could see you shifting uncomfortably at one moment. What was exercising you?
Well, I do think that this is about democratization, ultimately, and so we're just going to have to get used to the fact that there are going to be these alternative sources of news and information.
And some of it is going to be fake.
Exactly. And it's going to be up to people to decide for themselves.
OK, well, then Steve Fuller and, as they say, Helen Buckrose, Andrew Chadwick, thank you all very much. Next week, we're going to be mounting an all-out attack upon one of the most used and arguably misused terms in the contemporary vocabulary, that great, big, baggy, all-purpose concept called creativity.
This is a story about a man called Otto von Wächter. He was Austrian, a lawyer, a husband, a father, and a very senior Nazi. It's a story of life and love, and of a curious death. You could say it's a sort of mystery story. Otto Wächter is a Nazi you've never heard of, because he escaped justice. I'm Philippe Sands, and I'm going to take you on an unexpected journey to find out what actually happened to Otto Wächter. It's a journey that goes right to the heart of something called the Ratline, the Nazi escape route out of Europe that started in 1945. Along the way, we're going to meet an unlikely cast of Nazis, fascists, assassins, spies, sons of spies, lovers, murderers, and an elderly man who lives alone in a castle steeped in family secrets, who I've come to know rather well. To subscribe, just search for Intrigue, The Ratline, wherever you get your podcasts.